host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Cynthia Zarin. Cynthia is the author of the novel Inverno, 6 books of poetry, including Orbit and Next Day, new and selected poems, 5 books for children, and 2 essay collections. Her honors include a Guggenheim Fellowship, a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellowship, and quite a few others. She's a longtime contributor to The New Yorker and teaches at Yale University, lives in New York City, and the book that we're talking about today is Estate. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Cynthia.
Thank you very much for having me, Monica.
So you write in a lot of different forms, formats, genres. Do you have a favorite?
I wouldn't say that I have a favorite. I think of myself first as a poet. You know, I've been writing poems since I was very small, and I think that's where I'm maybe feel most at home. However, I've been a journalist since I was about 22, and now I have become a novelist, and that is a surprise to me, as becoming a journalist was a surprise to me. So these things have just kind of occurred, and but primarily I'm actually right now have written a libretto for an opera for children based on a book by John Burningham. So I like to try something new. It's a challenge, you know, and I enjoy challenges.
So you said you've been writing poetry since you were a child. Did you have role models as a child of people who made a living in literature, in writing?
Well, I think not as a small child. I did not. But I did have the example of a number of artists in my life, a life in art, if we could open it to that. My grandfather, who I was very close to, was a painter, and he wrote poems. And 2 of my aunts were painters. My father's best friend, who I became very close to, was a concert pianist. So there was this idea that, you know, my father was a lawyer, and most of their friends were lawyers and doctors, things like that. But there was this avenue that I could see of a life in the arts. I also took dance from a very young age, so I did know about ballet. So, and I played the piano. So there was a big emphasis in my house about on the arts.
It does make a difference, doesn't it, in what you can see yourself doing as an
adult? I think so. I was very set on it I never thought of being anything else. I mean, I think I would have liked to have been a ballerina, but I was so completely without talent that was not on the agenda, although I took dance for many, many years. And I do think, though, that piano lessons, dance training, all of that, going to the ballet and the theater, my grandmother had been a dancer with Martha Graham, all of that had a huge impact on not just my choice of a career, although because I don't really think it was a choice, but really how it occurred and the kind of rigor that was applied, the seriousness with which I was expected to take it.
You know, I've talked to writers who said, you know, they loved to read when they were a kid, and it never even occurred to them that somebody was, you know, had this as a career, writing these books. And, you know, it's because they weren't surrounded by anyone who had a career in the arts, it never even occurred to them until much later. And I think maybe I was a little bit that way myself, mm-hmm. you know.
I think I was very conscious that the books were written.
Yes.
That someone had written the book. And this is something I try to impart to my students. You know, whatever you're reading, whether it's William Carlos Williams or Elizabeth Bishop or Natalia Ginsburg or Elizabeth Bowen or Joan Didion, someone chose each word on the page and put it down just the way you are doing it now.
So you teach creative writing at Yale?
I do. I teach creative writing. Nonfiction prose and poetry.
And is that in a master's program or undergrad or both?
Undergrads, we do not have an MFA program at Yale, but we have an extremely active creative writing program within the English department.
Okay. So did you, you know, why did you decide to become a professor and also write? Is there a story behind that?
Well, you know, I've kind of had a dual, up until maybe 15, 20 years ago, I pretty much had a dueling career. I started, well, first of all, you know, as a poet, there's no expectation of earning a living.
True.
So you do have to have a job, whatever that may be. You know, we all know about Wallace Stevens and T.S. Eliot and so on. But I, just by, in a way, by happenstance, I joined the staff of The New Yorker when I was about 22 and became a staff writer when I was 24. So I...
just by happenstance?
Well, I think you could say that, maybe, or divine intervention.
Okay.
And so I learned on my feet, you know, in probably the best school that there was, how to write prose. And that's how I made my living for some time. And then over a series of years, I left and I went to Paul Muldoon had asked me to come and teach at Princeton to teach poetry. And I went and did that. Reporting when I had children was a little bit more difficult to do with the travel entails and so on. So I went and I taught at Princeton, and then I went back as a staff writer to The New Yorker, and then I went and taught at the Columbia Journalism School, and then I went back, and then I did both for some time and still do both. But teaching at Yale became more of the center of gravity in terms of a day job than reporting. Although I have had, I think, stints during that time where I was writing at least once a month, if not more, in terms of book reviews and theater criticism for The New Yorker.
Now, did you also do like hard news reporting?
No.
No. Okay.
I did not do hard news reporting. A little bit at the very beginning there, I wrote what are called notes and comment. I wrote some political pieces, but I didn't do hard reporting. Some of the pieces turned into reporting pieces. One was about a pair of emerald earrings, and another one was a kind of reporting into the past piece about Lady Jane Grey. But I don't do hard news reporting or war reporting, which of course I thought was extremely glamorous, but I did not do it.
Oh yeah, no kidding.
Well, at one point I remember writing a story, and a colleague at The New Yorker read this talk of the town, and he said, "You have to write what happened and not what happened to you." And I thought, well, that's my Rubicon.
Ah.
In fact, I'm always writing what happened to me, but it's not exactly me. It's the me who's talking about going to the play, who is very much, I would imagine, like you, a person who's gone to plays before, who's looking at that play. But I'm talking about how the play affects me, you know, or a writer at a time of political upheaval. I was doing that a lot during Trump won. How does a person go and see Richard III right now, and what does it seem like?
Oh, okay. Okay. You relate it to the current kind of climate.
Yeah. Well, how could we ever not?
So, yeah, really.
but not the kind of hard reporting, police beat, anything like that. I've never done that.
So,
I've never done day journalism, which I respect.
So tell me a little bit about Estate, the book that we're here to talk about today, and how that fits in with the other work that you've done, or how it's different.
Well, it both fits in and it's different. The book is called Estate in English and Estate in Italian, which means summer. It's a companion, but Estate actually works quite well. It's a companion piece to my first novel, equally slim. I always feel I'm doing my friends a favor by not writing Great Expectations. It's a companion piece, not a sequel, but a mirror. You do not have to have read Inverno to read Estate. And it takes place from April to June in 1 year, while Inverno takes place over long, actually during one moment in which the central character Caroline thinks about her past. But in Estate, while Inverno is in the third person, Estate is in the first person. And so the character Caroline is speaking for herself. So that's a different kind of book. It's a different kind of atmosphere or valence if somebody is speaking versus a story is being told. So that was a departure from my
from
first
previous
work.
Yeah. So yeah. Is this just your second work of public fiction then?
Well,
adult
yes.
fiction?
Adult fiction. Yes, it's my second book, my second novel. The first came out in January 24, and this came out last week, something like that. I have written a number of picture books for children, and I've also written two collections of essays, one about Italy and Rome called Two Cities, and a memoir called An Enlarged Heart, A Personal History. But this was these Inverno and now Estate are my two books of fiction so far.
Now, Estate seems extremely intimate and personal. So I'm sure people ask you, how much of Cynthia are you, or Caroline? Sorry.
Well, you know, Caroline is a character. You know, of course, she has many of the references that I grew up with, whether it's Cat Stevens or Billie Holiday or the Brownies book. But she speaks for herself. A number of people have talked to me about poet into novelist and what that means. But I've been thinking about this, and I also think there's a discussion about journalist into fiction writer, because I'm really reporting on Caroline. Caroline appeared, and now here she is. Harold Pinter said he doesn't write plays, he waits for the characters to start talking. And I feel, not to compare myself, of course, to Pinter, but I do feel that about Caroline. You know, she was talked about quite a lot in the first book, and then she kind of said, well, it's my turn now, and I'm going to speak.
So I found the book to be, the language to be extraordinarily wonderful. And that, of course, fits with your background as a poet. Do you, now when you're writing a poem, every single word has to be precisely the right word. And so even though a poem might only be one page, it may take days, weeks, months to craft that poem. Do you give that level of sort of attention to each word in Estate?
Yes.
Oh, my.
Yes. So I would say that the sentences in Estate have been revised at least a dozen times, every single one of them. I had submitted it, I think, to my editor, the really legendary, wonderful Jonathan Galassi at Farrar, Straus and Giroux, and maybe two, not quite a year, 18 months ago, and he read it and we discussed it and he edited it, and then there it was, and it was going to go to the copy editors, and I was fortunate enough to be handed a month-long residency, artist residency in Croatia, and I just did not feel that the book was there,
even though it had been accepted, basically.
Oh, yes. And Jonathan had edited it, and I just felt it needed. So I spent a month, probably about 12 hours a day, every single sentence. And then, of course, after that, there's a wonderful copy editor at FSG, Scott Auerbach, and he went over it, and we had many, many discussions about every single comma, every single contraction, and a wonderful old student of mine who's now at the Paris Review, Sophie Hagney, read it, and she had some places where she felt that Caroline needed to say a little less rather than a little more. And so that We went through that process. And so it is exactly that much work.
Wow. When, does that make you like want to write another novel or not want to write another novel, knowing what goes into it for you?
I think, you know, I do. I have a plan to. I don't want to speak too much about it, but it does come out a little bit out of the italicized sections of Estate, which are about graph theory and communications theory, and which, of course, leads us right into our own virtual and digital age. So I'm interested in writing a novel, but maybe not quite at the, certainly the sentences will get the same attention, but maybe with more characters or creating a larger world, which would be a new challenge for me. And I look forward to it.
Right. Because this, it's very much her internal world.
Yes.
Yes. So tell us kind of the, what is that world? Just give us a little description of what Caroline's world is. And what is she writing? What is she saying? What is she talking about?
Okay, that's a good question. I don't think anyone's... It's a very simple and direct question, which is, you know, what I always think is, what's going on here?
Yeah.
So Caroline is probably in her late 40s, early 50s. She lives in New York City. She has been married twice. She is separated from her second husband. She has... a number of children. That comes up for a little bit for discussion in the book. And
how many is it? I think three.
Three, but.
Okay.
She is separated from her husband. She has in a relationship with an old friend, and she falls very inconveniently in love with a man called Lorenzo, who is also involved with two other women. But I was just thinking about this the other day. Caroline's life is extremely complicated. Whether she's trying to find herself in the current parlance or not, I don't think she really is. I think she feels she's stuck with herself. It would be wonderful if she could lose herself, but she can't. And unlike many more traditional books, you know, in which, well, Lorenzo is a cad and she will realize this and get over this and walk into the new dawn with new ideas, or she and Lorenzo will do what my friend, you know, embark on what my friend Jeff Eugenides calls the marriage plot. None of that happens here. Nor does she have to go on a journey up a mountain to find herself or to Sicily or leave her life and go to a hotel room and redecorate it in order to have her erotic and emotional adventures. She stays right where she is and has that, as I think most of us do, in the midst of our lives, in which she's having a interesting lunch with Lorenzo and she has to leave because she has to pick up her daughter at school.
Wow.
Or she has to take her children to camp, or she has to find them bathing suits that fit, or she's making dinner for other friends. She's in the midst of her life, as most of us are. She does not have to leave her life. She has no intention of leaving her life. She's just trying to live a number of lives at once, which I think we all do in some way.
Yeah.
Also, one of the things about Caroline, which at least is important to me, is that Caroline has agency over her life. She's not a victim of anyone. She's made these decisions and she's making her bed and she is going to lie in it, and she accepts the consequences.
You know,
that.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because that's something that I've been thinking about lately, is this in our current kind of political environment, cultural environment, this idea of wanting to portray yourself as a victim.
Yes,
and I don't get it.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about that is that it is especially part of the patois about women. he did this to me, she did that to me. And I believe that Caroline and many of us, we do make our own decisions. And if we make bad decisions, well, we at least we made them. I mean, I was saying last night or the other night at a book event, you know, Caroline has never seen a plate glass window she didn't throw herself through. So, if you're that kind of person, you're going to get
You're going to get cut up a bit.
But that's her. She would rather have the experience than not.
Now, it's interesting because I was thinking of it more in the idea of like our politicians like saying that that America has been victimized by other countries in trade and stuff. And it's like, how can we be a victim when we're the richest country in the world? How does that even make any sense whatsoever? And
no patience with that.
Yeah, and I was raised in a way that I would almost, even if somebody, if I was walking down the street and somebody came up and hit me over the head and grabbed my purse, I would still be hesitant to portray myself as a victim. Because to me, saying I'm a victim implies weakness, and I don't want to ever think of myself as weak.
No, and I certainly, Caroline has her moments of, you know, bearing her, you know, doing what Joan Didion would call, you know, Joan Didion had in her wonderful essay on self-respect says, you know, it's hard. It's hard to be hysterical if you just put your head in a food fair bag, you know, and that is not a bad thing. Just stop it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There's time for this.
Yeah.
And just go on with your life. And I think Caroline is interested in a lot of people, and she's interested in how she fits into the world, but she's devoted to her children and her life, and she's devoted to Lorenzo, whether he likes it or not. So, but she's making those choices.
Yeah, I really like that. That, yeah, it's not, doesn't have to be about what's done to you.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Of course, there are many people in the world to whom really terrible things
that is true.
Are being done,
that
where
is
they
true.
Do not have any agency. And
yes.
We shouldn't forget that
for
a moment. But
right.
Caroline is not among those people.
Right, right. Okay, so the structure of the book is in the form of a long, long, long letter that may or may not ever be sent. Is that correct? Mm-hmm.
That is true.
Okay. So tell me why you chose to do it that way and how that impacts the book.
Well, I had begun many, many years ago a letter to another person, which then became a kind of catch-all for stories, for things that I made up, that things that this person told me. And at the end of that process, I had several hundred thousand words. And since, as you point out, I do many kinds of writing, I always say I'm a Grub Street writer. I've never seen written anything that I, like John Updike said, that I didn't imagine in 12-point print. But I don't. But I really had no idea what to do with it, and I just kept trying to put it together or edit it down because it was way too long and who would be interested in that. And then a friend of mine, very gifted, Leanne Chapton, who's the art editor of the New York Review of Books, said, stop trying to put it together, put it apart, take it apart.
Ah.
And I took it apart, and then I could put it together. And with the help, actually, of my wonderful UK agent, Luke Ingram, we drew the structure of that novel, Inverno, on a piece of paper, and then I was able to go ahead. But then I had a lot on the cutting room floor from Inverno, and there were scraps of Caroline just speaking, because Caroline had become a character in this long letter, just speaking. And that became the germ of Estate, here, letting Caroline speak for herself.
Okay.
So when I sat down to begin it, I just began. I had been writing a long letter, which is the first sentence in the book, I believe.
Okay. So it's sometimes hard to tell in as you're reading what is supposed to be things that really happened and what are things that she's making up.
That I'm not going to answer.
So that was a deliberate.
Oh, of course.
Yes.
She's telling her story, and it's a true story according to Caroline. I mean, we all tell stories about ourselves all the time.
Don't we? Yes.
We emphasize certain things. We leave out certain what we call telling details because they would tell something we might not like to have told, right? So yes. Caroline is no different. She is telling a story about herself, and I am really almost like a reporter writing that down. I remember a alternate title for An Enlarged Heart at one point was Domestic Dispatches. And I think there's a way in which Caroline is, this is a dispatch from Caroline. This is the state of Caroline right now, the state, as if you will, of Caroline. These are all her holdings, which are many.
So Estate is the title, which said means summer in Italian, which I did not realize, so that makes a lot of sense. But is that, tell me why you chose that title. And did you choose it to have that double meaning?
I didn't at the beginning choose it to have that double meaning. And then I realized it made perfect sense. It does take place April, sort of tilting into summer. And because I knew I wanted it to be a companion, as I say, not a sequel, to Inverno, which means winter, summer, made sense. And both books have epigraphs from Vivaldi from the Four Seasons, the Quattro Stagioni. So it's fine if people want to say estate, because I do think that it works as a title as well.
Right. Well, why don't you read a little bit from Estate for us, Cynthia?
Well, I will begin. I'm going to just begin at the beginning, and I'm going to maybe just read a number of pages The book begins with an epigraph from Elizabeth Hardwick's book, Sleepless Nights. Sentences in which I have tried for a certain light tone. Many of those have to do with events, upheavals, destructions that caused me to weep like a child. I had begun writing a letter to a man with whom I was in love. At first to tell him what my days were like when he was not with me, which was most of the time, but really to keep track of them and to convince myself that I had a life without him. And then I kept at that letter, writing every night over a number of months as spring turned into summer, because I felt that in the end I would have nothing else to show for abasing myself. What had started as a lark had become something else for me. I was married, but I was separated from my husband and had become involved with someone else, someone I had known for many years, and the man with whom I had now fallen inconveniently in love was claimed by not one but two other women. As usual, feigning the truth. For a short time, I pretended the situation with otherwise. First, I thought I would not become attached to him, and then, after almost no time had passed, I believed I could convince him to love only me. To me then, and even now, despite my knowing better, love meant what I had run away from not once, but twice, a life among towels and tablecloths and children, a solution to an algorithm I'd tested since I was a little girl. My childhood had been one of deprivation. My mother took little notice of me, and my father was at once peremptory and prone to scenes of emotional violence. But we, I was sure, would be happy. Later it was pointed out to me that this was a kind of hubris. Why should Lorenzo hop on one leg when he preferred a three-legged stool? After a while, it became a letter I did not plan to send, about which he occasionally made comments. I had told him about it, in which we spoke to each other. I recorded my daily life and the times we saw and more often did not see each other. Occasionally, I read bits of it aloud to him. By the time I began reading aloud, we knew each other well. Sometimes we played a game in which we spoke in each other's voices, and it was often difficult when I looked back on what I had recorded to know who was speaking. Many of the conversations I recorded were imagined, but that is the way in all love affairs. What one person says and what another person hears are often two different things. Much later, he would say I had fallen in love with an entirely different person whom I had invented. But why then that particular invention? In time, because I wanted to understand, or thought I might better understand, how I had become the person who might write such a letter and behave in such a way, behavior of which I deeply disapproved. Telephone calls at night, or worse, no telephone call at all, keeping my toothbrush in my handbag, avoiding certain street corners, telling lies. I also knew one of the other women, though not well, and there was that too. I had grown up in a time when we thought darkly of what we called betrayal. I also, like Scheherazade, began to tell him a number of long stories or tales, and to record the stories he told me. Again, some of these were true and some of them were not. For the most part, they were stories in which idiotic dangers were apparent to everyone but me, or conversely, showed off his or my own charming vulnerability. One or several were fairy tales. Some were stories about people who disappeared by water or by fire or into thin air. One was about a woman caught in a snow globe. At the time, I did not see the correspondences among these stories. I did later. I thought then if I told these stories, I would unravel the length of thread that led to, I want to say, the Minotaur's lair, but as always in a maze, there is more than one way to lose one's way. And even if that was the case, I was mistaken. If you tell stories to a Minotaur, you should not be surprised if he doesn't wait to hear how they end. When did I become interested in disappearance? In November 1961, Michael Rockefeller, the son of the then governor of New York, aged 23, vanished in New Guinea when his catamaran capsized and he drowned while trying to swim ashore. Or did he drown? His body was never found. How could that be? A story lurking in the mind's eye, a helicopter propeller over the river. He was a boy who loved beautiful things, and he had found them there living among the Azmat people. Some of these were dugout canoes made of nutmeg wood. Others, called bis poles, were intricately carved, made of trees that were stripped of their bark and turned upside down so the carved roots delicately scraped the air. In New York, the galleries of the Metropolitan Museum, established by his bereaved family to commemorate his disappearance, were a recourse at the museum with the children when I felt I couldn't look at the halls of arms and armor or the pond in the Chinese garden one more time. In the Chinese garden, the children had named the fish, the black and white one, the orange one with the red nose. And though now those names elude me, I used to pray that they would live forever, those fish. Last weekend, we were at the museum again. Sunday came around, everyone was bored, and again it was raining. To enter the Michael C. Rockefeller wing, you turn left past the Fabergé eggs and gilt snuff boxes, the tiny walnut that opens like a nutshell in the fairy tale, and a whale mask from British Columbia the size of a dogfish, with its open mouth set on hinges. Just today, a lobster man on the east coast of America was swallowed by a whale and spit out again. We were on our way to the cafeteria for cake. Next to the elevator was a show of John Marin drawings, and I recall decades ago driving down to find Cape Split in Maine, where he lived. There was a hobby horse in the bent grass by one falling down horse, which was the same hobby horse we'd had as children, made out of some kind of molded plastic, a chestnut horse with a white face. There were nicks in the painted hide where I had picked at it to see what the horse was made of underneath. Here in Cape Split was the identical horse in the beaten down yard by a trailer. There must have been hundreds of them made, a stable of hobby horses, and one had ended up in the basement of our house in Massachusetts. My brother and I took turns riding it, and I can still feel the hard saddle pushing the seam of my red overalls between my legs and smell the cold plastic when I stroke my cheek on the horse's brow as if it were alive. What happened to the horse? Absence is so much easier to love. As I wrote the letter, I addressed you in the second person, as one does. It was the only time I could be sure you were listening. Here is a little place marker, Tarquinia. I am thinking of the first story you told me in the kitchen that night after Pablo's birthday party, when you stayed to help me clean up. You were Pablo's friend, and he asked if you might be invited. It was January. Before that, although we had met now and again, we had not talked together alone. There were candles in the kitchen and piles of plates. Now, in your mirrored kitchen, it is impossible for me to not at least rinse the plates despite your chiding. That night, you told me the story of Antonella. Is that her name, or was she someone else, a similar story? A cinematic story, a man very much like you, but younger, but not so young, 30, perhaps goes to a wedding. He does not know the groom well, and the bride not at all. The invitation was sent to a friend who invited him to come along, but the friend is ill or unexpectedly called away, but he himself goes anyway. It's late spring. The pink oleanders are in bloom. It isn't far from Rome where he lives. Even the car park smells of jasmine. He is a theater director in the middle of rehearsals, but it is Saturday. He has had a headache all week, but perhaps if he gets out of Rome, he'll feel better. He is seeing someone. He is always seeing someone. He is a man who is attractive to women because he has a beautiful eyes, the color of, even now I hear your voice, what does it matter what color they were? And he seems sad, as though he is reaching always for something in himself that he cannot find. And of course the women feel they can supply it. And he has a way of just brushing their shoulders with an index finger. His aunt has a house outside Tarquinia. He visits her often, so the car knows the way. He is the kind of man who pays careful attention to elderly relatives. His mother is alive, but his father is dead. He himself is abstracted, thinking about the second lead. It was stupid to cast someone because you felt a little sorry for them. It was warm. The wedding was outside on the large patio of the villa. Tables were spread out below with white cloths in a clearing before the wood. Was it spring or had it turned into summer? I don't remember. During the ceremony, the bride kept her eyes down. Because he was standing off at a little distance, he did not see her face properly until the reception. By then, because a breeze had come up, she was wearing a white cashmere shawl over her dress, which was made of lace rosettes. There was a small mark on the inside of her arm above the elbow, where the side zipper had snagged her skin earlier. He had been on the outskirts of the melee around her, but then he found himself at her side. Because her glass was empty, he asked if he could refill it for her, and when she said yes, he introduced himself, saying his name and that he was a friend of so-and-so, who was unable to come. But as it was a beautiful day, he had come to wish her well, and he hoped that was permissible. As always, his courtesy was old-fashioned and slightly otherworldly. She was a singer. Later, there would be other singers, or perhaps she was not the first one. She was getting married, but she did not want to get married. She did not know why she had done this. It was lunacy getting married. She wished she was wearing something other than this stupid dress. She did not love this man who seemed now almost surreally to be her husband. It was a mistake, wasn't it, if she was feeling like this? He seemed to understand, yes? How had it happened, this conversation? It was cool under the trees. It was June, but in the shade, the pine needles clung to their scent of autumn and salt. Improbably, by walking just a short way together, they had disappeared into an enchanted wood. He was at once bewitched and preening a little, despite his usual feeling that the world was a dream in which he was a figure dreamed up by someone else because, after all, although he was generally successful with women with barely any effort, the reverse of effort, which he had found earlier than most suited him, a kind of languorous distraction. It is unusual to seduce a bride at a wedding. Her willingness, the atmosphere of fracas, her feeling of doom, of having made the wrong decision, had propelled her under the trees. Sometime later, he drove back to Rome.
Thank you, Cynthia. That's Cynthia Zarin reading from Estate. Italy comes up a lot in this book. Are you Italian?
No, I am absolutely not Italian, but I have a great, like so many people, I have a great love for Italy, and I'm usually there once or twice a year, and I've written a book about Rome and Venice, so Italy is what my place is.
Yeah, absolutely. It's beautiful. I was just there in September. I was in Levanto and Milan and Como.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. The lakes are so
beautiful. Yeah, I had never been to the Lake District before. I've been to Italy a number of times, but it is quite lovely to be there, isn't it?
Especially now.
Yes, especially now. Another thing from this reading that appears throughout the book is reference or about Michael Rockefeller and his disappearance. Is this, you know, why does she like fixate on this so much?
Well, you know, Caroline is very interested in disappearance, and in the book there are a number of relationships in her own life in which somebody disappears. And, you know, today, you know, the word for that is ghosting. And we all know how often we've all experienced it. Someone just simply does not reappear. And it is extremely disconcerting. In the time that I was growing up in this country, there were locally and nationally a number of disappearances. Michael Rock, I grew up when I was small in New York City, and the Rockefellers were a presence, and the disappearance of Michael Rockefeller is a legend. We also had the terrible story of Eaton Potts, who disappeared, and the little boy who walked to school and was never seen again. And beyond that, we had Amelia Earhart, the Lindbergh baby. All of these disappearances somehow loomed large in my childhood. Of course, I also grew up in the time of political figures disappearing, one assassination after another. So this idea of disappearance, I think, was part of Caroline's mind. And then the question is really, but how present is Caroline really in any of these compartments of her life? And there's a poem by Robert Creeley in which it has the line, "I'll win the way I always do by being gone when they come." So I think that Caroline's abstraction, you know, her children often say, you know, "Listen to me, you're not listening to me," elides with this idea of disappearance. Who is really disappearing in estate, and what do those disappearances and reemergences mean?
Yeah,
to her,
in her relationships, her marriages, she is the one who disappears, right?
Right. Yeah. She has left two marriages, which is a little unusual for a woman, and she is embarking on her own series of adventures or relationships.
What do you think happened to Michael Rockefeller?
I think he drowned and his body wasn't found.
Yeah.
That's what I think. And I think that is what happened.
Okay.
I do not think he was eaten by cannibals. I don't think. I think it's an absolutely tragic story.
Wow. Yeah. You also, in this section, as throughout the book, there are many, many literary references.
Yeah.
And I enjoy reading those. They also sometimes make me feel uneducated because I don't always know.
I'm sorry to hear that.
No, you shouldn't be. You shouldn't be sorry. It's, you know, I have a very limited education, really. I dropped out of college as a freshman to
it didn't hurt you.
No, it didn't. But, you know, there's things I wish I knew that I was more knowledgeable about. So it and sometimes, you know, when I read something like this that has those references, sometimes it inspires me to go learn more about a subject. So you should not be sorry.
Well, I think Caroline's, but you know, almost all of the references, Caroline's references, I mean, there are a number of Shakespearean references, but you know, Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest, but those are things many people who read such a book know. And most of the others really are to popular culture.
Yeah, that is
songs
true.
And somebody was asking me the other day if there was a song that went with the book, which one would it be? And because there are lots of songs mentioned, and I said it's probably one that's quoted, which is Cat Stevens' "Wild World." The line which is quoted in the book, "I hope you have a lot of nice things to wear." Caroline likes that line. So most of the references, I think, of you know, there are probably a few kind of more obscure ones. But I think most of them are things we share, or most people readers would share. And in terms of the sections in which she starts in that are in the third person, where she starts off as a little girl imagining that she could crawl through the lines of print and what that would be like, and ends up in Bell Labs and the first computers. That was, I had to do quite a bit of research to figure out those passages. And I had a student, Yale, who is a physics major, and he's since graduated, but he sat and gave me some tutorials on all of that, which was was very helpful. And also I'm learning quite a lot. Caroline is in a maze. She's in a maze of her own life. And so thinking about mazes and the ways that we become turned around, for example, in that section where she is trying to go and see her therapist and she can't figure out her way on the streets of New York, where she has spent her whole life on the Upper West Side. And so that's a sort of outward version of the maze, which is more interior in those sections.
Were there other subjects that you had to research in order to?
Well, very much the math and the Euler and the mathematical equations. For example, Lorenzo tells a story about going to visit Billie Holiday in Amsterdam.
Right.
In Brussels, in Belgium. There was a lot, I did a lot of research to figure out whether or not that was, could be a true story. And is it or isn't it? There was a lot of like going down those rabbit holes.
Now you use italics in here with there's various whole sections that are in italics. And why, what are they? What is the meaning of that?
Because they're interior, they're story. It's a story that's being told outside of Caroline's voice. It's stories by, I guess you could say, the omniscient narrator, who would be me, tracing her a different kind of even more interior history of Caroline than she's telling. It's going very far back to her earliest childhood. So that needed to be set off also, but it reflects her interest in these types of questions of communication and how do we communicate. After all, she's someone who's spent lots of her life waiting for the phone to ring, as many of us have. And so how do we communicate across these both physical barriers in what's now kind of cyberspace? How does all of that happen? And, you know, there's an interesting story about those maze sections, which is that I had a very, very close friend when I was in high school, but someone I'd been out of touch with the way one is. You know, I've seen him maybe two or three times in the past 40 years. But, you know, affection, and I'd heard of him this way and that way. And he wrote to me while I was writing Estate and while I was very intent on those sections. And I had a friend who's an architect who was helping me draw the maze so I could see where Caroline would be in it. So I was very involved in these sections, and I got a note from him saying, you know, I've been thinking of you and hoping your family is well. He said, but I'm really writing to tell you that I don't usually remember my dreams, but I had a very vivid dream about you, and you were lost in a maze.
Oh, my goodness.
So I tell that story because these connections between us, how do we know? You know, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of, you know?
Yes.
So those sections for Caroline go very far back to her interior life, in which she is trying to figure things out even as a very small child. Wow. She's trying to learn how to read the world.
Now, you talk about the omniscient narrator, and then we have Caroline herself, who I would call perhaps an unreliable narrator. Would you agree with that?
Unreliable.
And that is sort of something that occurs a lot in literary fiction, perhaps, is the unreliable narrator.
Well, I do remember, however, you know, I'm very interested in the unreliable narrator because I remember with absolute clarity my first encounter with that, which was a book that I read in on Cape Cod in the little library in the town that we go to, waiting for my mother one day when I was about 9. And it was a book by Shirley Jackson called We Have Always Lived in the Castle. And it was reading this book about these two sisters living in the house, and it's narrated in the first person. And at the end of the book, I was absolutely shocked to find out that the story that I was reading was not true.
Oh.
And it was an absolute shock.
Yeah.
To the system. As the British would say, it was a shock to the system. But I think I was so intrigued by that.
Mm. So is Inverno also have an unreliable narrator?
Well, I would say probably yes. I think there's some question of who is the omniscient narrator of Inverno. And in Inverno, the omniscient narrator is telling the story to another person, a second person. And that second person is Lorenzo.
Ah.
So the story of Caroline and Lorenzo takes center stage in Estate. Sometimes in Inverno, that character is saying, you told me that already, or please, you know, hurry it up already.
Now, is Lorenzo based on anyone you know or completely imaginary?
Oh, I think Lorenzo has always been completely imaginary.
Okay. Okay. So, Cynthia, when you're writing, do you write on computer or on paper when you're starting out?
I wish I could say I write on paper. I've almost always written first on a typewriter and then, you know, except when I was very small, or now on a very old laptop. And so I do write on the laptop now, or, you know, if I have an idea, I'll jot it down or something on a piece of paper.
A very old laptop.
Very, very old.
And the editing process on a computer is so much easier than it was when we relied on typewriters and paper, isn't it? Do you think it makes us edit more?
No, I think it makes us edit less.
Really?
You know, I try, and I do this certainly with poems and journalism, to constantly type out the whole thing again, because so much, it's so important. Something that if you just keep taking out words and putting them in, it's a kind of Mad Libs. You don't know where you are. Sometimes you have to see you have to be inside the paragraph in order to do the edits. So it needs to be retyped each time so that you can find out that, oh, well, you think that something's wrong in the sixth sentence of the paragraph, but actually the problem, the place where it's going off is in the second sentence.
Oh, That's interesting. So does that mean you'll have like two screens up or two, a version just, here and then another version?
Yes, and I also just keep scrolling down. So okay. It's an endless.
Okay. Okay.
Endless.
Okay. So then you may have like two versions of a paragraph and then you decide which one works better?
No, it's more sentences. I really write on the sentence level, not the paragraph level.
Wow. How do you decide when you're done? When it's as good as you're going to get it?
Well,
I know that's an impossible question to answer.
It had to get back in by a certain day. And, you know, at a certain point, you just have to feel you've done the best you can. When I was, my new and selected poems came out last year, next day, new and selected poems. And some of those poems I wrote in college, and I did not change anything. I felt this is the best you could do at the time, and to go back and change it from this rather down the years perspective, I think it would have been kind of fiddling. Mm. So I think with Estate, I just got to the end for a while, because as I say, it's sort of a companion, if you could see like maybe a mirror, a double-sided compact that you could open to Inverno. For a while, I wanted it to be exactly the same word count, and I was pulled kicking and screaming from my desk by my editor and family and partner saying, that is insane, you have to stop. I can tell you that they are 752 words different.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Cynthia, I want to thank you so much for being with us today, and we always close Writers' Voices with a quote, and I picked one of the sentences from Estate that really had an impact on me.
Oh.
Everyone can be reduced to someone who has been forgotten.
That's true, isn't it?
It is. So thank you so much, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you for having me, Monica.